This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Night.
So, let's be honest. This is a news show, among other things, but there's news, and there's news, and between the two of us, you're far more likely to know what's going on in the news department of the royal family.
I will accept this compliment.
So when you explain to me, and I definitely needed an explanation, about the wild speculation around Kate Middleton's apparent disappearance a few weeks ago, I did not think I had very much connection to that particular story until it turned out that I did.
Yeah, the internet was running wild with theories about what was going on with her. And then it turned out that she had, in fact, received a cancer diagnosis and was undergoing treatment, which was a very different story than what most people had been imagining.
And right when we were talking about that stuff, I have been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And I was trying to figure out how to talk to people about it. I think when Kate Middleton first came up in class, I don't think I'd told my class. It was a podcasting class, so they're obviously going to find out now, at least. And, you know, I was still in the process of talking to my family or even telling my colleagues about this. And so it seemed to me like I felt for Kate Middleton. all these people were, you know, like making up crazy stories about her. And she had this terrible thing that was happening to her that she was trying to figure out how to talk to people about.
I felt bad for her, too. And so today we're going to talk about what we talk about when we talk about cancer, how we talk about cancer, the literature of cancer. And I just want to say that I really appreciate your willingness to talk about this with me and on the show. And I'm also glad that you were able to get a brilliant friend of yours who has written about having cancer to be our guest for this episode.
Yes, this is a complicated conversation, and I can't think of anyone better to join us for this conversation than Sandy Weisenberg. Sandy Weisenberg, who writes as S.L. Weisenberg, is most recently the author of The Wandering Womb, Essays in Search of a Home, winner of the Juniper Prize in Nonfiction, and published by the University of Massachusetts Press. She's also the author of, a short story collection, The Sweetheart is In, an essay collection, Holocaust Girls, History, Memory, and Other Obsessions, and a nonfiction chronicle, The Adventures of Cancer Bitch, which is what we'll be talking about today. She has published prose and poetry in The New Yorker, Plowshares, Narrative, Prairie Schooner, New England Review, Michigan Quarterly Review, Colorado Review, and many other publications. She spent a decade as the co-director of Northwestern's graduate program in creative writing, and she lives in Chicago and edits another Chicago magazine. Sandy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We really appreciate your being here. So, just to dive right in, Sandy, as a surprising amount of humanity knows, including probably a good chunk of our listenership, at some point in December, Kate Middleton, aka Princess Kate, married to Prince William, vanished from the public eye. And this became a point of concern for like a lot of people I knew. And she remained out of view for so long, months, that a variety of conspiracy theories emerged about her. And then around Mother's Day, I guess like British Mother's Day, news organizations received a photo of her with her children that some of them published, and then they recalled it because they realized that it was a manipulated image. They put out an alert on it. And then eventually she issued a statement saying she had edited the photo herself, and she released a video talking about what had actually happened to her. She had been diagnosed with cancer and she was undergoing treatment. So clearly she must have been so hungry for privacy. What were your thoughts on the way that that played out and whether she was entitled to it?
Well, my first thought was, this is kind of vague. She talked about preventive abdominal surgery or something, and I didn't know what that was. And so you're saying she's hungry for privacy. Well, I was hungry to find out more, and I don't follow the royal family very much. But I guess I'm part of the teeming masses that wanted to know more.
I felt bad for her, to be honest. Like, I thought, like, I sort of had this feeling that, and maybe it's not true. I guess it hasn't really turned out that way for me, and we'll discuss that more as the show goes on. But I feel like you, even if you're a princess, you should maybe be allowed to announce that you have cancer when you want to, or not announce it if you don't want to. Or maybe she gives up that right by being someone famous? Does that make her different than anyone else? Or does no one have that right?
This is going to sound very mean, but no one asked her to marry a prince. And I was thinking, if like 5 years after the ball, Cinderella got breast cancer, that would be part of the story. And I always want full disclosure, and I might just be nosy, and that might be why I want full disclosure. But when the second Mayor Daley's wife had breast cancer, I wanted to know more about it. I wanted to know when it was metastasized and what was going on. And she was a public figure, but she didn't tell people. I don't know. Was she an we're talking about Maggie Daly now. Was she an accidental public figure? Not really, because she married a Daly. I think people want to know, and I think people, you should tell them. I know you disagree. Tell me why you disagree.
Well, I don't know if the, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, one of the reasons that we thought to do this episode, you know, was that I was in the process of telling people about my diagnosis, and I was trying, in some ways, I wanted to tell other people in my family at the right time, or a time that felt right to me. And then there were a couple times where someone told someone and someone told someone, and then someone called me and said, I'm so sorry that you have cancer. I was like, I wasn't ready to tell you yet, you know, and it sort of, I sort of lost control there. And so I guess I felt sympathy for her. But I also, on the other hand, I mean, I'm thinking there are a lot of famous people who, if you Google this, you'll find all the time there are famous people who have cancer, because all the time there are people who have cancer. But recently, King Charles, as we mentioned, the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, came out. They both have prostate. I don't know what King Charles has, but Lloyd Austin has prostate cancer, which is what I have. You write a lot about, in your book, Elizabeth Edwards, who was dealing with cancer at the same time that you were. You mentioned Susan G. Komen, Audre Lorde, Molly Ivins. You know, I guess I have some sympathy for people. I guess I feel two ways. One, you shouldn't be embarrassed to talk about cancer. That's why I thought it would be good to do this episode. But also, I feel like you should be able to talk about it when and how you want.
Well, like, you use the word control, and I think it is about control, because number one, cancer is uncontrolled cells. And also, you get cancer and you have, all of a sudden, it's there in you and you didn't have control. And so you want to get control of this thing. And you want to be able to say, like you're saying, you want to be able to tell people, and you don't want there to be rumors. And at the same time, maybe you don't have enough information to tell people. You know, you don't know the stage yet, or you don't know what the prognosis is, or you don't know what's going to happen to you. Is there going to be surgery? Is there going to be chemo? Is there going to be radiation? So maybe you want to keep that close to your vest until you know. So, yeah, it's two warring factions. People want to know, and you can analyze that. Why do people want to know? And then you want to be in control of telling them. And I think for me, I wanted people to know, and I wanted to control it. And my way of controlling it was having a blog where I controlled what I said about it and what people read about it. And I was public, and I read some of my blog passages on the radio, on public radio. So a friend of mine says writers are writers because we always want attention, and we're always like little kids who want attention. So this was my chance to get attention, more attention. And that was one part of why I was telling people.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You know, it's interesting, Whitney, I didn't even think about this when we were first talking about this episode, but when I was a beginning reporter, I was covering someone who got cancer, and I had to write a story about this person who was, in that context, a public figure, and about them having cancer. And I felt so uncomfortable about it for, I think, really the precise reasons that you're mentioning, the warring factions, Sandy, that you're talking about. That, I mean, I liked this person. I really respected them. And I wanted, my sort of fundamental instinct that I wanted to leave them alone was a little bit battling with, I think in that case, it really was going to affect people that this person, or it could affect people that this person was maybe not going to be at their job for a certain period of time. And I remember, just reporting the story and kind of squirming the whole time. And I wonder, Sandy, you were also a journalist. And if, in writing about other people's stories, when they draw the lines differently than you, how do you feel about it as a writer?
I had a boyfriend who interviewed Dick York. And for our younger listeners, he was the husband in Bewitched. And that may be the first Bewitched. There might be a second Bewitched. I don't know. And when my friend was interviewing him, he was on oxygen. And he didn't want that mentioned. And so my friend didn't mention it. And I thought that was wrong. Nora Ephron wrote Harry, When Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle. She was a wonderful writer on the page before that and after that. And she was famous for saying, everything is copy. You can write about everything. And she had been married to Carl Bernstein for a while, and she used to go around telling people who Deep Throat was. And again, for our younger listeners, Deep Throat was an anonymous source in the Watergate reporting, and you'll have to look up Watergate if you don't know what it is. But at the same time, she was diagnosed with a blood cancer in 2006, and she died in 2012. And I was just reading up on this. I don't know every single detail about this, but she had had lunch with a friend a few days before she went to the hospital for the last time. And her close friend said she didn't mention it. The only weird thing was she ordered dessert, and she never ordered dessert. So it's sort of funny. It's like women, when we know we're going to die, we get the cheesecake. And then And then also she ordered a taxi, and she lived really close to where they were eating. So that was a sign. But she kept it very, very close.
See, I think, and that's my argument, is that I think she has the right to do that if she wants. My editor, my first editor, a guy named Ray Roberts, died of pulmonary fibrosis, not cancer. But he didn't want a lot of people to know. And he went to a sanatorium and died. And he didn't want to see anyone. He saw like very few people. And he said, like, this, I'm not going to see you. He told me. We wrote letters, but that was it. And that was his way. He chose that. And I thought, I have a part of me that believes that, that sense of autonomy applies to any human, regardless of their station.
I mean, there's so much to say here about public and private health. And of course, I mean, fundamentally, we're talking about language. And so, Sandy, I was particularly struck by the passage in your book in which you tell your students you're sick. Whitney, of course, had to do that not too long ago. And I wonder if you would read the passage from The Adventures of Cancer Bitch about the way that you shared that information with your class.
Yeah. Before, I'd been at the hospital, and I could see people were getting a diagnosis, and they were crying in the hallways. And I just thought, oh, well, I'll never do that. I'm not going to be crying in the hallways. So I thought, you know, I should tell my students, and I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to get emotional. So I took my students down to the library because we were doing something in the library that was relevant. And I thought, okay, I'll tell them now. No, I'll tell them now. No, I'll tell them now. Okay, I'll tell them, you know, the class is about to end. I should tell them. So I wrote how not to tell your class about breast cancer because I think I did everything wrong. One, be grateful during class. You don't think about your cancer except during free writing when they're making lists that begin with because, using as a model a poem by Susan Donnelly called Why I Can't. The title of your list is Why I Don't Trust Doctors Who Are Very Good Looking. Two, tell them as soon as you know, on the day you get your terse diagnosis from the cold and good-looking blonde at the hospital. Don't wait until you have concrete information that your students will need, such as dates of classes you will miss. Three, wait until 5 minutes before class ends. While they are standing with their coats on, say that you have something to tell them, that you have breast cancer. Expect your voice to be calm. It will not be. It will break. You will be in danger of crying. Tell them that you will find substitutes for any class you'll miss. Tell them you're going to talk to a surgeon the next day, but be unable to continue, leaving them stunned. Then exit. Four, on the way home, think about how irresponsible you were. Five, at home, send an email to all of them telling them you're sorry if you freaked them out. Become paranoid when only one of them replies. Six, have a friend tell you that it's all about what you need, so whatever you needed to do was okay. Know that she's wrong. Your job, in a way, is to protect your students from your own mishigas. Seven, post this on the class's website and see what happens.
What did happen?
Nothing.
As usual.
Yeah.
When you send things to students.
I mean, you think you're the most important person to your students, you know, and then like 3 months after your class, they don't remember your name.
Well, I had a very similar experience. And, you know, neither of us are royalty, you know, at least in the technical sense. You know, but we do end up having, regardless, you do have to tell people, you know, students, but also family members, parents, friends, children, in my case. What's the right way to do it? I mean, you said you did everything wrong. I was really interested in that reading when you talked about it was your duty to protect your students from your own mishigas. But how would you have done it if without telling them?
I think I would have waited until I knew more and would have said, I'm having surgery on this date. And if I can come to class, you know, when the next class is, I will. Otherwise, I will get, you know, a very renowned and competent nonfiction writer to take my place. It's early stage, which is good. It's better than late stage. Because, you know, a lot of kids don't know the terms. So, you know, you tell them early stage is early. They found it early. And late stage means it's been going on for a while and it's not so good. And you tell them it's a very common kind. And you tell them what will be the same and what will be different. And you're calm. You don't just think you're calm, you really are calm, you know. And how did you tell your students?
Well, I did the same thing that you did, like at the end of class, because I had said to them, first I was going to do like, I'm having a health issue and I might have to miss some class, right? And I thought I could just go with that vague thing. And then I found out like, okay, I'm going to have radiation treatments for my prostate. But at one point they were like, you should do surgery and it's going to be on this day. And that was going to be in the middle of the semester. And I was going to be out for 4 weeks, no matter what, you know, and that was coming. And then suddenly, you know, my chair was like, if you're going to take leave, you need to get someone to teach your class now. Cause we can't, it'll be hard to hire someone late in the semester. And so suddenly everything became immediate. And suddenly one day I realized like, I'm not going to be here next week.
Oh.
And I had to say, I'm not going to be here next week. And this student, you know, this other professor is going to teach the class. We got a great, you know, friend of mine, Cody Smith, to teach. And, it was difficult. And then the kids like had, students had written a card and like turned it in to me, which was super nice with their like comments. And I didn't see it at first, right? When they sent all their comments in. And then I saw it like 2 days later and had to write them an email like, oh my God, that was so nice. But I wouldn't have known if I should have opened it in class anyway. And then I would have probably gotten upset. So it was probably good I didn't open it right there. But I felt guilty to be leaving them. I felt bad about it. With my kids, it was a little bit easier, but I don't know. I mean, I've read your book, so I know, you know, sort of the course of your diagnosis, you know, like the problem is when information changes, you know, like at first they were like, the doctors were like, look, this is early stage and it's going to be really easy. And I want to shift here and talk about the language of cancer, mm-hmm. right? And here's a piece of language that you probably got to talk about was your Gleason score. Do they have those for breast cancer?
I never heard of it. Maybe I have no idea what that is.
I get these scores, a Gleason score, and now recently a Decipher score, which is a genetic a testing new thing of how aggressive your cancer is going to be, right? And so like my Gleason score was intermediate. It's not going to be a big deal. And then I get a Decipher score back and they're like, this is an aggressive cancer and we have to change what we're doing and we need to speed things up, you know? And so you're learning this new language. And a friend of mine who has cancer now said that she was trying to find a way to like reprocess the language of cancer that comes to you from the medical establishment in her own head to translate it into language that she felt comfortable with, right? That made sense to her. And then use that as a way to talk to other people. Was that your experience? Maybe your blog was a way of doing that in the first place.
My blog was a way. Also, I didn't remember things. I took notes. My husband came with me. And then afterwards, I would say, he didn't talk about such and such. Like we'd go to the oncologist. He goes, yes, he did. You know, I just couldn't hear things. I couldn't take them in. And I'm thinking, too, when you're talking about language, about Susan Gubar, I don't know how to say her last name, G-U-B-A-R. She's a feminist scholar at the University of Indiana University. God forbid I should say it wrong. And she had ovarian cancer, and the word the doctors kept using was debulk. They had to debulk her. They had to take things out of her. So she wrote a book called something like Memoirs of a Debulked Woman. And so she turned that language and made it her own. So that's one thing to do. But there is a lot of vocabulary that you never had before. Like, there's language that I can't even tell you anymore what it is. But for some things, you're positive or negative, and I was neutral. So I learned that. I learned about lymph nodes, that they were all over the body, and it probably at some point in my life I knew that, but I probably had forgotten. And the weird thing was, I went to a doctor for a second opinion, and I said, how many lymph nodes are you going to take out? And he said, how many chairs are in a room? And we're like, what? How many chairs are in a room? And he said, yeah, I don't know how many I'm going to take out. It depends on how many need to be taken out. Whereas my own surgeon had said she does sentinel node biopsy, which is something I hadn't heard of before, but I found out about, where they take out one lymph node and see if it has cancer on it. And if it doesn't, they don't take out anymore. So those are more physical bits of vocabulary than you had. Yours were more assessment terms, I think.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back. There are images. I have found that the doctors do use metaphor to try to explain. They're doing a good job. And the language that I've remembered the most is the non-technical language, when a doctor has given me an image that is helpful. One doctor was talking about what's called nerve-sparing surgery, which people sometimes have for prostate cancer. And he said, well, the nerves around the prostate are kind of like the sticker on an apple, and you can peel them off, right? And then save them, and then you take the apple away, right? And but the sticker's still there. And another image, actually, a doctor didn't say this, but a friend of mine who had radiation said his doctor used the image of, like, there's a bunch of, like, for radiation therapy, there's a bunch of flies in a glass, and every day we're killing a few of them, and we're watching where the rest of them go, and then we kill more and more each time we do it until there are no flies moving in that glass, and then we're done. So those I find interesting that doctors need to resort to that kind of metaphor. I found that helpful, like a useful use of language in my process. I don't know if you had any images that you remember from that. I remember you were talking about, you write about getting an MRI and having these, you used it, having like these fruit strawberry baskets placed on your breasts that they used for the biopsy. That was a striking image that I remember.
Yeah, that's all I could think of to describe it. But it's weird they would use the image of a sticker on an apple, because a sticker on an apple is not a natural thing. Maybe the doctors are young enough that they think apples come with stickers naturally. You know? Did you get a book? They gave me a book. Like a booklet, a fat booklet, and it explained a lot of things. And Dr. Susan Love, who's died recently, she was big on explaining cancer to women from a feminist point of view, and she talked about different ways of treatment, and she said some are like fast food and some are like a restaurant. And so outpatient surgery is like fast food. where you just go in and go out. And that didn't seem necessary to me. It's weird. Because you don't want to, like, well, who is the fast food? And who is the customer? And
so you felt like the language needed some workshopping, really, in the end.
Yeah, it did need a little workshopping, yes. Did you feel that way?
I was just happy to get something that was not a word I'd never heard before in some visual language that I could picture. Was helpful. I didn't think about your Apple point about the metaphor. Good point. You know, but then you're probably a better editor than I am.
No, it's just easy for me to think about something because you're telling it to me now. It's not being told to me. I could never decide if I wanted to have reconstruction or not. And reconstruction is such a funny word because I write sometimes about race and history.
Yeah, I know. I don't like that term at all. That's a terrible term.
And if you do that, then you think of reconstruction. That was what we were told in school was a bad thing, but what you learn later in life was a good thing. When the South was supposed to undergo reconstruction and there were the feds occupying it and trying to make it a more equitable place, and there were freedom schools for blacks, and there were blacks in the legislature, and then that's reconstruction with a capital R, and then reconstruction with a small r is getting a new breast, and you're getting it because they're either going to put this bag of saline under your skin and force it there, or a bag of silicone, or else they're going to take fat that you have and put it in there, and fat from various places. And at first I was thinking, well, I'm never going to get reconstruction. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll get reconstruction. And I talked to some doctors and I talked to some of their patients. And then my surgeon said, we'll give you skin sparing mastectomy, which is also called SSM. And so they take away the breast, but they leave a little more skin than normal so that if you want to, you can expand it into another breast, or you can just have it there. So it's like slightly lumpy, but I was very distressed. Recently, a friend of mine talked about when you have breast surgery, your skin, your breast is misshapen, or your body is deformed. And I said, it wasn't deformed. It was just like this, and this isn't going to help your people on the radio. But those people who remember, again, Senior Wences, where he was like a little hand puppet made out of your hand, where your thumb is his chin and he's talking. I mean, that's what the skin-sparing mastectomy looks like, or it looks just like two fingers that are flattened on the place where your breast was. It's not disfigured. It's just, you know, this little skin there. And I'm still ambivalent after 15 years, or I know it's really 17 years. And I'm ambivalent about my decision not to get reconstruction. And then I'm also sometimes defiant because I feel like that's my little political statement, that if 1 in 8 women get breast cancer and everybody gets reconstruction or wears a prosthesis, a breast prosthesis, as opposed to a cranial prosthesis, which I had a prescription for, which is, in other terms, a wig.
Cranial prosthesis. Women, oh, my God.
I don't know if I saved it or not. I didn't get it, but I could have gotten a cranial prosthesis. I feel like not having a breast and having it show makes people uncomfortable. And when I say people, I think my mother. I don't know anybody else who's uncomfortable with it. But yeah, cranial prosthesis was great. It was a great term.
That's like, that is wild. I remember when I was in high school going shopping for wigs with the mother of a dear friend who, she had sons, and I was, I don't know, I was very close to her and I went shopping with her for her cranial prosthesis, which that was not the word we used. That did not come up. And I'm also reminded as you're talking of, have you read Michael Ondaatje's Running in the Family?
You know, I just got it. I know it's been around for a long time.
There is one of my absolute favorite moments in that book has to do with, I think it's his mother. She's like on some form of public transportation. And it's just like the sly kind of wit of this. So she's on public transportation in Sri Lanka or something like that. And someone is groping her, but she has no idea because she has, she's had a mastectomy and she has like a piece of foam or something under her shirt. And so this guy is groping her and he's sort of standing there all smug, like, look what I'm getting away with. And she looks down and just starts like, is just like, this is not even. So it was just sort of one of the, I feel like that might have been one of the first depictions of breast cancer I ever read. And I sort of loved how in that scene, she's kind of like getting one over on him is the way that it's portrayed. Like he thinks he's, you know, like I've accessed this woman's breast and I'm harassing her and I'm completely getting away with it, which on Sri Lankan public transportation happens all the time. And she's kind of snickering to herself a little bit. And it's just maybe one of the first kind of literary depictions of that I remember reading. But there's so much here like that's so interesting about like some of what you're talking about in terms of like disfigurement or whatever, like that's like it's ableism, right? It's ableist language. And we don't think of like cancer isn't exactly disability, it's illness. But like the way is that like language is attentive to like the ways that it can be pejorative when that's not actually what's going on, or like diminishing when that's not actually what's going on. I don't know. It's like an interesting question to me of like, how do you characterize illness or change accurately and also respectfully? Like, I remember going through a late draft of my book and like finding ableist language and taking it out. But that might be something that's like a more, like I think that, of course, people thinking about that has always been around, but it seems like it's much more prevalent now that people might understand more readily why you might object to, like, say, the word disfigured.
And it's covering it up. And what I love about Audre Lorde's cancer writing is she talks about after she had her mastectomy and she went to the doctor's office, and the nurse or receptionist said, next time, please wear your prosthesis because being obviously with just one breast is bad for the morale of people in the waiting room. And of course, she gets angry and writes bad for morale. I mean, and then she goes on and is very eloquent about the politics of breast cancer.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back. What's interesting about when I was reading your book, I mean, rereading it and thinking about it now differently than when I did not have cancer, the breast cancer is it has to do with appearance, but also like sexuality, right? And of course, the prostate is, you know, responsible for creating sperm. And also, like, if you have yours removed and the nerves are not spared, it's very hard to get an erection. So suddenly, you know, in a way, talking about prostate cancer is very embarrassing. You're like, how do you tell your kids about that? You know, I mean, I've never talked to them about my sex life or, you know, and so, but that's really what most of the conversations are about in prostate cancer, you know, and you have conversations like, well, if you get this treatment and you can't get an erection, you can have a penile implant, not a term that sounds particularly exciting to me, or you can take injections to, you know, have an erection. And those are the suddenly this world that you're in where that is what you're discussing, you know. And it's, I don't have an answer for that. I just say, like, fortunately, I think it helps to have been a writer and have gotten used to writing about embarrassing things. It's kind of your job. I think it might be harder for other people. I mean, your book is admirably frank. But my grandfather died of prostate cancer, so I kind of knew this was coming. And I didn't know any of these things because he never did talk about it, you know.
What's interesting that yours is invisible.
Yeah. People keep saying, you look good. I'm like, it don't matter how I look.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So you had surgery.
No, I'm going to have radiation.
And you're going to have radiation, not surgery.
I had a surgery last week to prepare for radiation. If you want to know what that is, I can happily tell you. They put little trackers in your prostate and then like a gel pack to inside of you to protect other organs from the radiation, basically. I have a bionic ass now. That's how a friend put it.
Mm.
I've always wanted one.
You didn't know you wanted one, though. Right? And so, you told your students that you would miss 4 weeks, but are you going to, or did you miss?
I'm going to take leave, and when was approved for leave for the rest of the semester, after mountains of paperwork and tremendous back and forth with MetLife, our insurer, and the insurance company for the university. But I want to go back to, we've already mentioned Audre Lorde, and Sugi was talking about another, Ondaatje's book. And one of the things that I appreciated about your book, and I want just to get out because we're a literary podcast, is for you to talk a little bit about, you reference a lot of books about cancer in Cancer Bitch. I wonder if you could talk about some of the books that were most influential for you.
I loved a few books. There are a lot of bad books about cancer. There is a great book by Evan Handler, who was in Sex and the City, but I'd never heard of him. And, oh, here it is. I put it on the floor. Time on Fire, My Comedy of Terrors. And it's about having leukemia. And I just picked it up in the nonfiction section at 57th Street Books. And I see it was copyright 1996. So it was way before I had cancer. It just looked like a fun book, if I can show people. It's red and blue and green, and there's a picture of him wearing a scarf and smiling. He's smiling really big. And it's called Time on Fire, My Comedy of Terrors. So you don't really know what it's about until you read the back. And it's funny and yeah, read it a long time ago, but I still remember some of the scenes. When I had cancer, this was my favorite book. It's called Cancer Made Me a Shallower Person. And that's in reaction to people saying, people want to know that there's some redemption, that cancer made you deeper. It made you more grateful for every day. It made you appreciate what you have. It made you change your priorities. And so this is the answer to it. And it's basically kind of primitive cartoons. And she talks, the first is about the very first one. Well, you can't see that well. She talks about when you tell people you have breast cancer, people are thinking, don't look at her chest. And people say, which breast was it? And she says, I doubt that more internal forms of cancer bring about the same degree of social awkwardness. For example, if somebody says, I'm a kidney cancer survivor, people don't say, don't look at his kidney area. So I don't know if that was your experience.
I don't find people trying not to look at my groin because they already don't do that.
And then She talks about...
Especially not my perineum, which is where the... that would be hard. You have to lie on the floor.
Right. Yeah, you think of perineum mostly with women, not so much with men, I guess. You hear about it, because when you hear about childbirth, there's the perineum. And then she gets METS, which is short for metastasis. And then after I read the whole book, I found out she died, and I was really upset. And I really liked Our Cancer Year by Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner. There was a movie about him. Was it called American Splendor? I don't know. But he eventually died. And I didn't read Audre Lorde's The Cancer Journals until afterwards. I guess after I was writing the blog or after I was being treated, because I didn't want to read anything written by someone who had died, though I did read Miriam Engelberg's book, not knowing she had died.
And we're going to have you read actually the passage where you talk about that in the book next. And I just wanted to say, I want to respond to you talking about the way people want to talk about cancer as a positive, make it into a positive experience, you know, in some way. And it's just, it is not. And what I felt at different times, I mean, you're a survivor and I should survive. But I could not have, you know, and there were moments when you realize like, oh, if I get this score on this test, I'm probably going to die within 5 years. You know, and you recognize that it's just random. You know, I would feel differently about that. There's no overcoming a thing that's just random. It's like, I don't know, the closest thing that I can imagine to it in terms of like not being a character building experience is like, what were the chances of getting hit by an IED when I was in Iraq in a Humvee driving around? It didn't, like my bravery or intelligence or heart or love of humanity wasn't going to help one way or the other. And there was nothing to learn from it other than you got lucky.
Right. And actually, Miriam Engelberg, is that her name? Let's see, what is it? Yeah, it's Engelberg, who was the shallower person. She talks about she once was hit by a bus and it didn't hurt her very much. Well, people are always talking about getting hit by buses.
All right. Well, would you, I've had a lot of help from friends, and I also have discovered suddenly friends who have cancer or who had it and hadn't maybe told me about it. I wonder if you could talk about the importance of friends in your book, both those with and without cancer, and read a short passage about that.
Yes. People kept giving us free dinners, which is nice. Everybody wants free dinners, right? And then after surgery, somebody who I wasn't even that close to brought me some lasagna, which was like really nice. So my husband is named Link, short for Lincoln. Link has noticed that everyone wanted to give us free dinners. Our second one was with our neighbor, Anand. He and his wife are what the French called les voisins de palier, meaning neighbors on the same floor. I suppose there were more apartment buildings earlier on in France than, say, England, and thus the phrase was invented. I don't know if there are equivalents in other languages spoken in densely populated cities. We ate at the neighborhood veggie place, where not enough is organic. We got to talking about nipples. I said mine had to be removed in the mastectomy because there might be disease in it. Link said it was preserved, that he was paying attention to that part of the surgeon's talk. What did he think? It can be moved around like a maraschino cherry on a sundae? I looked it up later. It can be cut and replaced in some surgeries, but not at fancy hospital, according to the pink handbook the hospital gave me, which is the size of the original Our Bodies Ourselves, and I pasted a Medusa over the pink rose on the cover. We were also talking about donating bone marrow for some reason. Anand has plans to see if he's a match for someone who needs a donor. Link said he had been planning to donate marrow or plasma to a woman in his office, but she died. Oh, I said, pretty sure I knew who he was talking about. Of breast cancer? Yes. For some reason, I started laughing. Then I told Anand how my friend Peggy had offered to loan me books, one of which is The Cancer Journals by Audre Lorde, who died of breast cancer. I don't want books by people who died of it. I thought that was very funny.
Thank you so much. I think I know I also really appreciated that passage. So as you were mentioning earlier, The Adventures of Cancer Rich was originally published back in 2009, 15 years ago. It's quite a while. And it's going to be reissued later this year. And you speculate a lot about the possibility of dying in the book, and yet happily here you are. And I'm curious about how your thoughts on and your language for cancer have changed since you wrote it, what it was like to revisit the book, and how this new edition coming later this year will be different.
I'm in the process of editing it with a new editor. Actually, he's also the publisher of this very small press called Tortoise Books in Chicago. And it's like looking over anything, like you think, oh, that was really good. And then you read something else and you think, oh, gosh, why did I write that? I think cancer treatment has changed since I wrote it. There's also been more attention paid to the environment and cancer. And there are lawsuits, I think mostly by Black women, against relaxer companies, because there's been shown connections between lye relaxer and uterine cancer and ovarian cancer. And there's an organization, Breast Cancer Action, that is always looking into the environmental effects on human beings. There will be addendums in the back, or addenda, about what it's like to live without a breast and what it's like to live after cancer, and about some of the more political aspects of breast cancer. What happened is when I told the University of Iowa Press that someone else was publishing the book, they were fine because they had never put it out in paperback, and this will be put out in paperback. So that's great. But they said they will now make the book out of print until it comes out in October. So it's very hard to find it online. It might be in some bookstores. You can buy it used, and you might be able to get the electronic copy and the audio version, which I have never listened to. Somebody else recorded it, and it just, I don't know, it makes me too self-conscious to think about it. But in Breast Cancer Awareness Month, you will be able to get the paperback.
Here's the hardcover, which I'll hold up for our YouTube viewers. Sandy, thanks so much. I just want to say, for me, like, the humor of the book is super helpful. I mean, it's very serious, but recognizing that it's okay to laugh about embarrassing things and funny things and weird things that are happening to us while we go through this process was at least helpful for my sensibility of life. And I appreciate it. I appreciate that that book exists, and I encourage readers to go pick it up, The Adventures of Cancer Bitch, and Sandy's other work, available, as she said, at a used bookstore right now, and soon at all bookstores near you.
Thank you so much for having me, both of you.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Ann Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!